This is Winging It Podcast, the podcast for people who don't have their shit together.
Now you caught my heart for the evening. Kiss my cheek, moved in, you confused things. Should I just sit out or come harder? Help me find my way.
Messing me up my whole head, teasing me just like Tita did Martin. Now look at what you starting. Schoolboy crushing it ain't on the hush. The whole world see it, but you can't. My peoples they complain, sitting raving rant.
Come on.
Your name is out my mouth like an ancient chant. Got me like a dog as a pause and pant.
All right, we're here with Winging It Podcast. So we have in the studio today, or in the restaurant, in the place, the establishment. The Ethiopian restaurant.
Etete.
Awesome. We have Dante Tanner, and it's hard for me to do like a very short intro for him because I've known him since he was, you know, young boy Tay, way back in the day. Dante Tanner is he's a commissioner with the Fairfax County Planning Commission. He's a politician who actually ran for office for state delegate in Virginia. And he won, and then he lost, and we're going to talk about that for sure. He's an Air Force Academy graduate, class of 2001. Fired up.
Okay, we go way back.
We go way, way back. And with that, we're just going to kind of get started. So, Dante, you know, welcome to the studio.
Thanks for having me today. I really appreciate it.
Yeah.
I understand that you have some experience and history with the Ego Check.
I very much do, yes.
So I'm going to let you go ahead and define it for us.
So, at least for me, and I always break this down to several states as well. So it's ego and pride. One's internal, one's external. For the ego check, that need to always be right, the need to actually have the attention, the need that no matter what you say, you can't look bad in that instance. Mm-hmm. That's completely, you know, that's the ego check for me in that sense. And then for me, I always have to go a step further than the pride check, in that it's okay to open up. It's okay to ask for help. It's okay to not be perfect and expect people to expect me to be perfect. So for me, yes, the ego check is a very real thing for me. The pride check, even more so. I need both of them to get through days. So
yeah, okay.
I'm definitely here checking my ego, checking my pride, and let's go.
All right.
Good shit. Well, yes. I'm present. I'm in the moment. I love being around you, and I love like just kind of connecting. And so in this space, I'm completely checking my ego, and I'm here for you, man.
Yeah. And I'm eager to learn. I think it's important for us to tell our stories and our journey. So my checking my ego right now is checking anything that makes me want to like bombard you with 25,000 questions or jump in. All I want to really do right now is be present and hear your story. And that's my ego check.
All right. So Dante, kick us off with who are you?
So, it's funny. I was actually going to say one thing as far as like my own ground rules as well, right?
Oh, today, please give us your ground rules.
In my hope,
please.
For today's conversation, right? Ask me a direct question, I'll give you a direct answer. Ask me a vague question, you're going to sit there and listen for a little bit.
I'm going to ask you plenty of vague questions.
But in all that today, the entire intent is to be honest, to be open.
Yes.
It's kind of weird. We were talking at the restaurant the other day. I was looking for an opportunity for what's just to be free and have the real conversations, the painful ones at times as well.
Yeah.
So if you have questions and you want me to go a little bit further than that one, feel free to ask them. I'm not going to say no to any question.
Okay.
Unless you ask me to do something like illegal. We might have to get off camera, then I'll do that later on. But
you might be able to talk about that one later.
I still would be recorded right now. So that's the intention. So somebody asked a vague question of who I am.
Yeah.
And every time somebody asks me that question, I answer it differently every time because the truth is it's a constant process of rediscovery of who I am because I have no idea most of the time.
Man, tell me about
who
it.
I am.
Let's talk about it.
And in that moment, I know who I want to be. I know who I need to be.
Damn.
But when you start asking who I am,
yeah.
Honestly, I mean, I have to break it down to the most simple level. I'm still that 5-year-old kid that's still trying to get accepted by the other folks in this class in hopes that they don't pick on me and bully me. In some ways, I'm still the young kid at the academy who came from a very weird background for most folks.
The Air Force Academy.
Yeah, I was just about to qualify.
The Air Force Academy. And just trying to fit in with everybody involved there and get through, because let's face it, that place is hard. I'm a politician who just wants to serve his community, but yet understands that there's a game that needs to be played in all of it. And at the end of the day, it's like, I just want to serve. Mm-hmm. That's all me. But at the same time, I'm also just a dad.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You know, with a sweet little girl. It's like, if I used to be a stay-at-home dad and did nothing else, I would be good.
Yeah, that's real.
Because she is dope. She's cool. And when I pick her up, she runs over to me. I'm like, you know what? Nothing else really matters. So to answer your question, it's not really an easy way to answer it, but all of it's true.
Mm-hmm.
And then I didn't even touch on most of it, but you know, that's, they all apply. You are the sum of your experiences.
When I like to think of that question as the naked truth, like when you strip away all of the stuff that you do, like who are you? Like what do you mean? What do you stand for? What do you believe in? Like
who what is your philosophy on life?
Yeah, where's your philosophy? Yes, indeed.
Well, philosophy on life is, in my opinion, a little bit different than who you are.
Yes.
My philosophy on life is kind of goes back to our conversation about definite major purpose.
Yes.
It's always to raise the standard.
Mm-hmm.
You got to be better tomorrow than you were today.
Mm. Why is that important?
Because it's a progression.
To you.
To me, it's a progression of moving forward.
Mm-hmm.
The worst times of my life have always come when I was stagnant. I was not making myself better than I was. I was not trying to push the envelope to excellence.
Mm-hmm.
I used to talk about my campaign all the time, the Air Force core values. And after a while, it starts to sound like a cliche, but it really isn't for most of us. Mm-hmm. Where integrity first, service before self.
Excellence in all we do.
Excellence in all we do. And that's actually the one that matters the most to me.
Mm-hmm.
Service is great, and that's part of who I am. Integrity, I am a terrible liar. And I will always be a terrible liar. But excellence is what really will really shut me down from relationships. It will shut me down from interactions, or even myself. If I'm not pursuing excellence, I'll get into a state of depression, if you will, where I am not my best self and I don't know how to move forward. And the only way to get through it is to move forward.
How do you know you're not pursuing excellence? How do you know you're in that place? How do you know you're stagnant? What does that even mean? How do you know that? What does that feel like?
What it feels like, it feels like a weight, mm-hmm, that just keeps you locked into where you are. And it starts changing my emotional state, for example. Mm-hmm. Like, so if I feel like I'm not pursuing excellence or I'm being hindered from pursuing excellence, I actually have a tendency to start even lashing out a little bit. Mm-hmm. Like, why are you trying to stop me from being my best self?
Mm-hmm. So I was just going to ask what your best self is. Like, what does that mean? Like, especially in relationships, what does that mean?
Oh, look at you asking this question. Shoot, what's my best self? I haven't found it yet, and I never will.
Yeah.
And that's kind of the point, where if I think my best self is who I am today, then I'm not pursuing who I am to be better. So I have yet to meet the best version of myself because I'm still pushing myself to be better.
Are you ever satisfied with you in the moment? Just, are you ever satisfied to just be present?
I wasn't. Until the day my daughter was born.
Ah.
Hmm.
And this is I get parents. Parents all talk about the same thing. And hell, when you had your kids, you said the same thing too.
Dude.
I was like, oh, that's just something parents are supposed to say.
Yeah.
But when I had my kid, I remember what everybody said, especially Rashad. He always says, you'll figure it out. You'll get it later on. My daughter was born, and that was the first time in my life that I was in the present, where I wasn't battling with something that had happened to me in the past.
Mm-hmm.
I wasn't struggling about where I was going to go in the future.
Mm.
I didn't care. I just wanted to be there with her and watch her look up at me and smile.
Mm.
And that's the only time I've ever been present. Mm. And actually, I never thought about it that way before.
Yeah.
Because that's a problem with most of us.
When you said, before you said, you know, I'm constantly struggling with the parts of my past, and then, you know, constantly worrying over where my future is.
Yeah.
And I'm trying to understand how you get to, you know, enjoy, you know, all of the wonderful things that you've already done and appreciate that.
Do you?
Or have you yet?
I have. There are moments. And there are times where if you're able to step back because you've done something so amazing, right? You've accomplished something that you didn't think you could accomplish. You're able to sit there in that moment and enjoy it. Mm. The problem for me is always that it's very short-lived. Because one, I always think about like, oh man, you know what? Most of the time, I was actually kind of just winging it. Mm-hmm. So that's why I love the name of your podcast.
Yeah. Right.
I mean, even looking back at, let's even talk about the entry to the academy, right? That's a common point, going back to that far. People say, oh my goodness, you were so prepared to go to the academy. Like, what did you do? It's like, I was just trying to get it step by step. I had no idea what I was doing. Yeah, I was really just, do this. Okay.
Right.
Let me figure it out as I go along.
Reacting.
You know, and it was always reactionary in a lot of ways. So when you accomplish it, you think, man, I could have done it better because I had no idea about most of this stuff. Mm-hmm. Same thing with running for office.
Yeah.
It's almost accidental.
Oh my goodness, are you kidding me? I keep joking about him. I'm going to write a book called The Accidental Candidate.
Yeah. I like that.
Because
I like that. You heard it here first. The book is going to be The Accidental Candidate when he runs for governor or after he's governor and he runs for president.
Oh, right. Lord. But yeah, that's like every candidate, they have this image they present out to the voting populace, right? Where we have it all together. We know what we're doing. We have a streamlined process, etc.
Yeah.
And most of us, we only have the reasons why we ran. That's it. Mm-hmm. Everything else we're figuring out as we go along, and it's building a car from the frame while it's moving down the freeway and hoping that people don't notice that you don't actually have a car.
Oh, gosh.
Until you...
So good. This is so great.
And that's mostly most politicians' life. Uh-huh. That's, hell, it's business life. You know, everybody... Yeah. We'll post things on Instagram, so you think they have it together.
Oh, please.
Okay, can I do? I have a question. I'm sorry to interrupt you. I know I ego checked and said I wouldn't do that, but
I said ask me a question.
I'm just do it anyway. So I struggle. This is something I speak to these guys about and to Rashad about with imposter syndrome, right? What perpetuates my imposter syndrome is that, you know, you have successes while you're making shit up, right? Mm-hmm. And then you continually, you know, are successful and you're like, at some point, these people are going to figure out that I'm full of shit and I'm just making this up. So, you know, it's what I'm hearing from your story right now is... you know, your own version of imposter syndrome. Like, you know, I'm building this thing. I'm building the car as I'm driving it. And no one really realizes that I'm just making this up. I'm winging it. I'm making it up as I go along. Yes. But then there's always that perpetual fear that someone's going to figure it out.
Man, that's the truth. No, when you start talking about it, like the imposter syndrome, one thing that I realized, probably right halfway through my campaign, is that whole term fake it till you make it applies to everybody.
Yeah.
Everybody is just faking it until they make it, and nobody really actually makes it. But when you talk about those successes, that's what people are banking on. And they say, oh, you've made it. You've succeeded. But
you basically just faked your way there.
Let me tell you how I got there.
Right.
And I could talk politics and the national level and how some people became, you know, the leader of the free world by faking it and they actually made it. But when you start looking at like how people are, for example, like you look on Facebook, you look on Instagram, you look on Twitter, they only advertise the good stuff. But Lord knows I would love to actually have somebody say, oh, all right, look, I got here, but I don't know how I got here. Mm-hmm. This is all I cared about. I don't remember most of this stuff. And you know what? It worked out. Thank you. I'm glad that it worked out.
Right.
And I look at my campaign that way. And it's because, again, I only knew what I was running for. Mm-hmm. That's right. All I knew. How to do it. Who to go talk to. How to connect with folks. Like essentially, you have a district where you have everybody in it. You have to make a connection with everybody in your district, knowing that you're so different from them. Mm-hmm. You're trying to figure it all out as you go along. And in the end of it, it's like, all right, I know I got in because I really care about service, I care about excellence, and I care about integrity. But everything else, can we cuss on this thing? It's like, well, you're just making this shit up for real. Because at the end of the day, you're only advertising the positive. Mm-hmm. You're not advertising the fights you have with your campaign staff. You're not advertising the awkward moments you have at fundraisers where somebody really makes you, for the first time, feel black in a bad way.
Yeah. Objectified.
Oh, my goodness. Objectified. Mm.
I want to come back to that. I'm gonna hold that moment because I want to provide some. Mm-hmm. I want to provide a little bit of background that gets us to the campaign in that moment.
Okay.
You said that you're the 5-year-old kid who just doesn't want to get bullied and really just wants to be accepted.
Yeah.
You originally grew up where?
So I was born in Southeast DC,
mm-hmm.
Berry Farm.
What?
Right. my dad was in the military, so we moved around a lot. Mm-hmm. I'm 6'2" now, but I didn't hit my growth spurt until high school. So I was always a small kid in class. And of course, because you're raised the way you're raised, you go to certain communities, like for black communities, oh, you're just that white kid, that doesn't really care about us. I'm like, no, I'm black.
No, talk about the white kid thing.
Yeah,
what are you talking about?
So the way my parents raised us and the schools that we went to, the education level we had, the standards set for us, we talked a certain way, we behaved a certain way, not because of anything else except I didn't want my mom to beat me or check me down in the middle, right. In the middle of a restaurant.
So you got beat. So you got beat growing up.
Oh yeah.
All right. There we go.
Whooping saved my life.
So I know where you grew up.
Exactly. But because you talk that way, you go into other communities that aren't used to that. They say you talk white, and then therefore they assume that you are white.
So talk about that, because this is kind of an identity concept. Like, you're talking about gaining acceptance. I feel like the real sort of gaining acceptance in it, as well as you talk about wanting to just be your best self, and that's your definition of excellence. At the end of the day, you just want to be accepted for being who you are. But who you are is this person that other black people, you are clearly a black person, right? You grew up in Berry Farms, right? Before, you moved later, right? You were your parents were in the military. But like, it's clear who you, like, it should be easy for you to know who you are and be accepted for that. But that's not what was happening.
No, it really wasn't.
Yeah.
Whether it was because, like, the classes I was taking, where I was always trying to take the better classes. Like, oh, yeah, I'm in fifth grade, but let's take some high school courses. Raising the standard. I mean, that's been...
Striving for excellence.
That's striving for excellence.
That's who I am. But when you start looking at, like, how others view that, they think you're trying to be better than them. And it's like, no, I'm not trying to be better than you. I'm trying to be better than me. Mm. And then you're getting rejected from both sides, so now you're not being accepted, and you're not being your better self. Mm. And this is this constant struggle, because it causes that identity crisis where, yeah, like, well, I'm black. I grew up black.
And you want to be accepted.
I want to be accepted because I love being black. Mm. And my grandmother went through the same thing. So my grandmother was half black, half white. Mm-hmm. And she didn't tell us this till literally her deathbed.
Is it that you have to make adjustments to yourself in order to fit in either place?
I'm not actually sure how to answer that question. Do I have to make adjustments to myself, right?
Yeah. Like, how do you straddle these worlds?
I honestly think it goes back to your first question, who am I? Who I've become has been that person that straddled all lines just to make sure that I fit in and not feel what I felt before.
Yeah.
And it sucks because I grew up a military brat, right? I went to 9 different schools. So it was, acceptance was a big deal for us because, especially in your elementary school, right? You're battling with everything that you're going through. And you've been to 4 schools before you even got to this one in the 5th grade.
Mm-hmm.
Right as kids start having their bonds or friendship, they've known each other for years and years, and they see you and they don't accept you because, one, you're not how you didn't grow up with them. 2, you're not who they expect you to be. And as much as we like to say we don't want to change who we are so others can accept us, we do.
Code switch.
We have to, because that's how humans are made.
Mm-hmm. Plus, acceptance is important.
It is important.
Feeling like you belong is important.
It is.
Yep. The societal structure. Like, we were created to be together. So when we are rejected by somebody we want to be with, it hurts.
Yeah.
So then you try to, you find yourself trying to change who you are, even if it's just subtly, so that you're accepted by that group.
Mm. So this is interesting. I want to jump into your political run. But we'll do that after we come back after a quick break.
Sounds good.
All right, cool.
But y'all thought y'all wasn't going to see me? I'm the Osiris of this. Wu-Tang is here forever, mother. This 97, I ain't my and my rats. Let's do
atomically. Socrates, philosophies, and hypotheses. Can't define how I be dropping these mockeries. Lyrically perform armed robbery. Flee with the lottery. Possibly they spotted me. Battle scarred shogun. Explosion when my pen hits. Tremendous. Ultraviolet shine blind forensics. I inspect view through the future. See millennium. Killer bees sold 50 gold, 60 platinum. Shackling the masses with drastic rap tactics. Graphic displays melt the steel like blacksmiths. Black Wu jackets, queen bees ease the guns in. Rumble with patrolmen, tear gas, lace the function. Heads by the score, take flight inside a war. Ticks hit the floor, die hard fans demand more. Behold the bold soldier, control the glow slowly. Proceeds the blow, swinging swords like Shinobi. Stomp grounds and pound footprints in solid rock. Who got it locked, performing live on your hottest block. Your hottest
block. We're back with Winging It Podcast, sitting down with Dante Tanner. The future governor of Virginia.
President of the United States.
President of the United States.
One step at a time, right?
Yeah. Future governor of Virginia. Delegate in the future, but however the fuck you want to get there, man. So let's just get back into it. There's a couple themes I feel like that are sort of present in a lot of things that you're talking about. The first thing I think is the concept of identity.
Right.
The other thing is this concept of validation or vindication. Right, we're using acceptance, but oftentimes I feel like, you know, the other side of the coin with acceptance is this sort of concept of validation or vindication. Well, actually, it's not even on that coin. Vindication is something totally different, mm-hmm. Right? And that's see, I told you.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
And the validation is, can't you see? Can't you see? No. Like, look at all that I'm doing. Like, you talked about wanting to serve your community. Who is your community?
Oh, man. You know, we actually have this saying that kept coming up through the campaign all the time, which is that Virginia is my district, right?
Mm-hmm.
Because a lot of folks...
Because you're going to be the fucking governor, yes.
Well, no. The intention of that statement was that delegates will often say that we don't care about this issue because my district doesn't care about this issue.
Hmm.
But you're voting on issues that affect the whole Commonwealth, right?
That's
so
correct.
If it's statewide, it's not just about your district. Your decision affects everybody. So when I look at who is my community, mm-hmm. I look at the immediate one, right? My neighborhood.
Sure.
You expand it out to my House of Delegates district.
Sure.
And you expand it out to your magisterial. No matter how you expand it out, you start realizing that it's all kind of the same. Mm. Everybody has the same concerns, except for maybe like, oh, I care about this road versus this road. Mm. But like, oh, so you care about roads. Got it. Like, that's a concern we all share. You just care about the one that's closest to you.
Sure.
But in the end, we all have common points. We all have common concerns, common interests in things that we don't care about because it's just political noise. Mm-hmm. So when you start talking about who my community is, man, that question is very simple, yet it's very complicated because I consider everybody in my community when you're running for office because everybody has an idea.
Mm-hmm.
Most of them better than mine. So yeah. You take all the good ideas, put it together to actually make everybody's lives better. And as long as you stay to your values, everything else is just a conversation.
Do you feel like your community accepts you?
Now.
Okay.
And I define that community conversation based on the layers that we just talked about, right?
I understand.
So there were times where certain parts of that community did not accept me. Mm-hmm. Whether it was...
Which parts?
It depends on the day, honestly.
Mm-hmm.
Or even the context of that conversation. So some folks will say, all right, you're not a serious candidate because this guy you're running against is too tough and we can't beat him. So we're going to ignore you and focus on everybody else. Mm. It doesn't matter everything I did, but work put into it, money raised, message, etc. They don't care about that.
Mm-hmm.
They care about odds. Mm-hmm. And therefore, they will reject based on odds.
That's a political community.
That's a political community.
Okay.
Then on the other side, I've actually had situations where, I won't name names in this case, but there were churches who did not let me come to their church because I have a white wife.
Hmm.
So for me, that hurt probably more than anything else because I'm like, well, no, we're just talking about our community. It doesn't care about why I chose who I married and for what reasons and my family. That's my family. It's beautiful. That's what we all are about.
Did that sort of harken back to a time where you felt that you weren't accepted by black?
Absolutely. That was the first thought that came up.
Yeah.
And there's one church in particular, Heritage. It was a phenomenal church. They were amazing. They walked me in. They still welcome me in. I wanted to join that church, but my wife's Methodist, so so we wound up going that route. But when you start looking at like how I wished and hoped all communities were, there were some churches I called wouldn't call me back, and I found out later on why. There's other ones that invited me until they fight and found out my wife was white, and they said, no, we're not going to have you come here now. So it got to a point, yeah, it hurt all those same feelings that I had growing up. I was like, God, I can't, I thought we'd change. And I know we're battling the outside, the Corey Stewarts of the world, who are the alt-rights, and that's the obvious, villain, if you will. But a lot of times when we start looking at ourselves and our own communities, we do more damage to ourselves because of what we think it should look like.
Yeah.
Or what we feel comfortable with. And that blocks a lot of opportunity going forward. And in my campaign, I think I was probably more hurt by that than anything else that happened. I mean, I literally even had somebody come up to me and says, I used to be a racist, but being black is cool right now, so I'm going to donate to your campaign. Weirdest conversation I've ever had.
And you absolutely accepted his money.
Absolutely did. I took a check on the spot because I appreciated that he at least said it. He was there to support, etc. But
that says something about, though, that someone who... He's probably not used to be a racist. It's still a racist, right? Is willing to accept you enough to support you.
Yeah.
And then, they've made it clear that they don't support anything outside of that which sort of that expresses and advances, I'm going to use the term, white supremacy.
Right.
And then you call people who look like you, who come from a community, a similar life experience. They've experienced issues in their lives that you experienced, and they reject you on something as small as, well, your wife is white.
Yeah.
So you can't even come here and talk to people who you seek to serve.
So we put it like that. It's even more emotional when you think about it from that perspective, because when I break down your district, and it's funny, so in politics, it's probably one of the very few places that you can judge a person based on their appearance, and it's deemed okay. Hmm. Everything is broken down by race, it's broken down by gender, it's
one
broken
of the few down places. By ages. I like that you see it that way.
I say one of the few places. But no, in politics especially, they break every community down. They call it the demographics, right? Tell me about the demographics of your district. Mm-hmm. And in my district, it's less than 2% black.
Okay.
Yet I still sought, because that's the community I really want to serve, because I see all the issues.
And it's your community.
It's my community.
Even though it doesn't reflect beyond 2% anyone who looks like you.
Yeah. It's my community, because those issues are still deeply in my heart, because that's what I want to do. But you have to be at the table in order to do that.
Absolutely.
So I still sought their approval, their attention. And
wow.
Some did, some didn't.
Right.
But to kind of see the divide within our own communities based on little things like that, it bothered me, but it didn't dissuade me, if that makes sense. Yeah.
Did you knocked on a lot of doors. In doing so, did you see black people, and were they surprised to see you?
Yes and yes.
Yeah.
But the second part of that question, it's actually people were surprised to see a candidate at their door, period.
In the black community?
You know,
in
just
everyone.
The
whole district. They said they never had a candidate come to their door and ask for their vote.
Mm-hmm.
And that's actually what persuaded a lot of the votes that I had. So people say like we outperformed everybody else who previously ran in that district. It's honestly because we went and talked to a lot of people personally. It was
you actually seek to serve them.
And seeing as how my opponent at the time, he had never knocked doors in the neighborhood. They said, oh, we haven't had anybody come to our neighborhood in 10 to 16 years, 20 years. And it's like, oh, got it. He never wants to go and talk to the community. And I thought that was a wasted opportunity on most elected officials' part.
Sure.
But on the other side of it, it's like, oh, this is a huge opportunity because all I want to do is serve and listen. Mm-hmm. I hate raising money. Lord knows I hate raising money, because you have to call your friends, you have to call people you don't know, have these awkward conversations, but they judge you based on how much money you raise.
Yeah.
But the what wins elections is the time you spend talking to voters. And honestly, that's where every candidate feels comfortable, because it's not awkward, it's not painful, it's real. You have real conversations at the door. I had one gentleman who asked him about what he cared about the most. And then his husband came to the door, and their son. And their son actually spoke and said, I just want people to stop bullying us based on how we choose to live our life. Mm.
And what does that mean?
So it was a gay couple with an adopted son. Okay. And they were feeling pressure from neighbors, uh-huh. from the community, from society as a whole.
Discrimination.
Absolutely. Yeah. And when they started crying at the door and said, we just want that to stop.
Mm. Wow.
And I was like, well, dang, this is simple. All we have to do is be the best versions of ourselves and accept the communities that that are in our community. That's it. We don't have to do anything else. Just love. Mm-hmm. It doesn't take any effort. And yet, this is what people are talking about.
Yeah, so if what I'm hearing is that at the end of the day, what you're doing in politics and what, you know, your mission in life is to just serve all people, regardless of what their race is. And sure. you want to be an advocate for your community, whomever those people might be, the champion for them, and provide whatever resources and opportunities they need.
Yes, right? That's it. I mean,
and you sort of expect everyone else in the middle to be the same.
Yes.
Which is a way to raise a standard.
Yes.
You want people individually to look outside of these sort of artificial lines of demarcation that we live with.
Right.
And just decide whether or not is this person an asshole or not.
Yep. and it's funny too when you talk about like running for office. Like the problem that most politicians either A, they step into the arena with this mindset, or they adopt this mindset later on, is that winning becomes more important than serving.
Yeah.
Mm.
So they'll do everything they can to win because this person won. They beat this tough challenger. But then they forget why they ran in the first place, and then they stop serving. They'll compromise more and more and more until all of a sudden you can't really tell why they got into the race in the first place, why they still serve, and what they actually stand for now. Mm-hmm. They have the talking points, and you get in long enough, you start realizing when something is a stump speech versus something that somebody believes. Mm-hmm. There's two very different things.
How do you reconcile as a politician, because that's where you are now? How do you reconcile becoming someone who knows that in order for you to even continue to serve, you do have to win, right? And then reconciling that against really just wanting to be the best version of yourself.
Yeah.
So in this case, the best version of myself does actually include winning. I am a very competitive person by nature.
Sure.
So winning does matter, but how you win matters more.
Process.
So if I won, but had to compromise everything that I believed in, everything that I stood for in order to get to that place, then it's not a win.
Hmm.
But if I am able to win my way, which Lord knows I'm stubborn enough to keep trying, then the win becomes more important. It becomes more valued for myself. It becomes more meaningful for the folks who voted for me. We always joke, say, all right, if you shoot a basketball, you hit glass, you have to call glass, otherwise it doesn't count, right?
Right, I remember that.
Call your shot.
Yeah.
Same thing in politics. Like, all right, I meant to do this because this is who I am, this is how I mean to run.
Mm-hmm.
And if I don't do it that way, there's no point. Mm-hmm. Honestly, I might as well just stop running, focus on just being Ev's dad, which is my real job.
So, I think that a lot of politicians start out with the intention to, you know, like just make a difference, and then they become affected by the mechanisms that keep our political process the way that it is.
That's true.
The outside influences. Have you thought about, you know, like what it would take to be able to maintain your passion and your drive despite all of those other things that are going to happen? Because you're going to be overwhelmed, and it's going to be hard to find Dante Tanner in the middle of all of this.
No, so it's funny. There was a point in my last campaign that I actually lost myself for a little bit there.
Okay.
Because raising money became so important, so absolute, that I would walk into a room and see people as the donations that they can potentially give to the campaign.
Mm.
at the beginning of the campaign, I was like, look, can you help me out? I don't care what you give. I just need help. But the noise that you hear, not even from the other side, it's from your own party that you hear that you need to raise more, you need to raise more, you need to raise more. Call people you haven't talked to in years and ask them for money. If they're on your phone, call them. If you know that they might be willing to donate because they, whatever, call them. Ask them for money and ask them for more than they're willing to donate. And you do that enough every day, the game becomes about raising money versus why you got into the race in the first place. And there was a period there last year where all I thought about was raising money. Because that was all I was feeding. That was my input. You know, and if my only input was raise more money, then I started becoming a more terrible person on the doors because I couldn't make that distinction for a little bit. Then I talked to my mentor, Tom Perriello. He says, stop focusing on the money because it changes what kind of candidate you are. And I stopped. Literally, we stopped. And for some reason, all the money started pouring in after that.
My next version of that question was to address this concept of, and then the money started pouring in. Do something with what I just said.
Man, you just put a whole bunch of stuff out there that's almost left me weeping on this one, right? But you're right, though.
Perhaps you just be you.
There's certain things that, for example, like suits. Politicians need to wear suits.
Right.
Dress for the job you want. That's just one of those facts of life. I'm a t-shirt and flip-flops kind of dude on a best day. So I get that. So I have to change that aspect of it.
Yeah.
However, I don't feel like I have to hide as much as I did beforehand.
So Dante, excellence is not a destination, it's a way of life.
Yes.
And you already exhibit it. So
appreciate
that. If I can offer anything, I'll give you that. Last question before we get to your tattoos.
You want to talk about those?
I mean, I think it's a beautiful story. So.
What happened on election night and how did you feel?
So on election night, I had the check mark, the green check mark you see on, you know, the news where this candidate has won.
Been declared winner.
By this many votes. And this is, oh man, that was the most euphoric feeling ever. Because they kept telling us the entire time we could not win. You cannot win. You will lose by 20 points on a good day. You're a first-time candidate. You're black. And you're running in that district. You can't beat him. That's what they kept saying. That was the run-up the entire time.
I want to provide a little more context. Your opponent had been in office for 16 years, I believe.
Yeah.
In previous elections, no more than about, I think, 10,000 people had ever shown up to vote. 15,000.
Yeah.
Total. That night, over 30,000 people showed up to vote. You brought out all the voters. And you were declared the winner. You fucking won. You won the election. It was also the 51st delegate in the state of Virginia. So your win was the one that actually tipped the scales in favor of the Democrats inside of Virginia. And you beat the chairman of the Republican Party, of the Republican caucus, right, for Virginia. It's vindication.
I was actually going to use that
validation.
Word.
Validation.
Validation.
Yep.
It's acceptance. Mm-hmm. It's holy shit. This is everything I've wanted in my life. There's excellence.
Yep.
There's the standard.
Finding a place.
There's a place. Serving your community.
Yeah.
Everything. All in that moment.
Yes.
What happened?
So, man, I got it. Reliving that night is the best memory I have. Reliving the next day is the most painful one I've ever had.
It's the day of great despair.
I was so happy that I forgot everything that I was going to say in my acceptance speech. And to my staff, my team, the supporters who had joined with us that night, we kept it really small because we were going to share the outcome. And it's like, well, if I lose this thing, I want to be able to have the freedom to go throw shit around without being judged or seen. But if I win, I wanted to be with the people who, you know, my family and my staff. That was it. So when we found out we won, nobody knew what to say, what to do. I got calls from everybody from sitting delegates in the House of Delegates here in Virginia to Barton O'Malley was the first call that I got.
Chelsea Clinton retweeted something too.
Yeah,
didn't she?
She did. She said, this, if you think your vote doesn't matter, look at this race and see, I won by 68 votes on election night. So the feelings you had for that one, no matter what happened after that, I knew it was going to run again because that feeling, gotta have to admit,
you were a national winner.
It was a vindication.
So here's the thing. Your win was vindication for everyone.
Yeah.
Like, that win was the vindication for everyone.
Right.
Not just you.
Right.
You and got to finally represent everyone.
And the calls that I got that night from national news organizations.
Yeah.
Asking for an interview.
Yeah.
It goes to the other side of that feeling. I didn't believe it.
Yeah.
I had been warned and told for my whole life that the system is rigged against you and they will always find a way to beat you. Mm-hmm. So that night, wow. I was like, look, I got calls from organizations that I only dreamed of being interviewed by. And I said, if you don't mind, I want to wait until after tomorrow's canvas and then have the conversation once this is completely official because my opponent hasn't called to concede yet. And there's a process. I want to respect the process. They're like, there's no way they're going to find 68 votes. You've won. Just give us your feelings. It's like, I respect that. But I don't believe it yet. I need the final confirmation because, again, we've grown up hearing the system
is
rigged
against you. The system is rigged against you and we'll lose.
And the next day, so I didn't go to bed until 4 a.m. that morning.
Of course.
I was up waiting for something to happen. I was like, I can't go to bed until I believe this is real. And when I went to bed, I was a delegate. When I woke up, I was a delegate. And I was having a conversation with another delegate saying, here's what we're going to go do. I was like, slow down. What about the caucus? There's no way they're going to find 68 votes. And then they found 183. So all those feelings that I'd had, like the excitement, gone. The anxiety exploded.
Yeah.
You know, because like, what just happened? So for that, you know, I say it took days.
And it's like they drag you back through the trauma over and over.
Right.
And then here come those old thoughts. They have rigged the system so that you can't win.
Right.
So that even when you fucking win, you can't win.
And that was the entire emotional process. So I say a few days. It wasn't a few days to get over it. It took months to get over that.
Yeah.
It took days to actually be able to sleep, to stop, sit still, and figure it out. And you know, of course, you're talking about winging it, right? No politician should ever admit this, but when something like that happens, there is no closure. There's no like resolution. If I lost by 20 points, like, man, I gave my best effort, but this happened. Got it. Not my time to run.
There's no answer, and it's okay to not fucking be okay.
Mm-hmm. Right. And in that case, I didn't know how to be. Mm-hmm. Like, I really was unsure if I should be gracious, if I should be outraged, or if I should just. So I literally sat in my basement, not moving, because they told me I can't do anything. That's the worst part about it. I can't do anything about it. The process has to work itself out, and they have people doing that one. And my campaign manager says, stay at home, we'll call you later, we'll keep you updated, but don't do anything. Don't say anything, don't be out there, just let the process work. Which is the worst place for somebody like me to be in.
Yeah.
It's like, wait, I can't fix this, I can't do something to help myself out. So I sat there, family got concerned. My wife and my mother-in-law had to call in a friend. They brought over a bottle of whiskey. He says, we're gonna sit here, talk about it, vent it. I joke and said, I watched Baywatch, the one with The Rock. That's my man crush, right?
I fuck with Dwayne Johnson.
He's my crush too.
You can't not feel good after watching a Dwayne Johnson movie. I don't care who you are.
It's on my table, by the way.
Exactly. So the plan worked. You know, I watched that. I felt better. I passed out. You know, we're gonna get to that one later on, right? We'll interview you, so your table right now. But when you start feeling that, like, okay, got it. Like, that was the first moment I was able to let it go, and sleep, and then wake up and try to figure out a plan.
So let me ask you a question. So how do you have the fortitude to continue to want to pursue this thing? It sounds like a soul-shaking experience, right? And then one that's, like, slowly, like, drawn out over a length of time, which, like, can cut away at your soul. So how do you still get up and say, I'm still going to run for office because I still believe and I still want to be able to make an impact, even though you've been through that experience?
Man, that's a great question. honestly, there's part of it that's you. Right, the reasons you ran in the first place still matter, even if you lose.
Mm-hmm.
So if you run for office, you better have a really good reason to do it. Because when you're at the worst, that's going to be the only thing that keeps you going. In a loss, that's what keeps you going, because you pay attention to the person you lost to. How do they vote? You're still voting the same way, but worse? Because you think you've somehow been vindicated or given a mandate from the people?
Yeah, validation for his position.
That's how they view it on their side. So that's part of it, right? Mm-hmm. But that's not enough.
Right.
Yeah, not enough.
What really gets you going is the people who come up to you afterwards and tell you they voted for you and why they voted for you. Because it lets you know that your message, your authentic message, resonated so deeply that they recognized you from a crowd, came across the restaurant to say thank you for running and ask if you're going to do it again. Mm. I mean, I used to go to my favorite restaurant all the time, and I got mistaken for LeBron James way too much. It was really uncomfortable.
Wait, wow. Is that why you wear the hat?
That's why I shaved my beard, really. are you LeBron? LeBron James. I don't look like LeBron
Nobody
James.
Nobody ever fucking mistaked you for LeBron James. No,
they did. They did. I was seriously. They would tell the bartender the same questions.
No, they didn't.
I was in Vegas one time, uh-huh. and somebody thought, "Are you LeBron James?" I'm like, "I'm 6'2" and broke. Do I look like LeBron James?
Yeah.
Do I look athletic? Do I look like a
yes? And you're black.
Our nose are different, right? Different, whatever.
You look athletic now. You've gone through a transformation. You look
beautiful. Well, appreciate it. You know,
feel on your muscles before you leave.
You know, you want to check my teeth too?
No. And you speak so well.
You're so articulate.
But going back to your question, the thing that keeps me going is the last time I went to that same restaurant where literally every time I went there, somebody asked that same question. Mm-hmm. LeBron James every time, and one time Grant Hill. It was weird.
Grant Hill?
Don't get me started. Somebody mistook me for the guy who ran for office,
mm-hmm.
That made me feel like, oh, wait a minute, I'm getting mistaken for myself.
Which is good.
Which means that it resonated. People paid attention. People heard our message. People knew what we were talking about enough to actually know my face in a restaurant.
Like, you look like Dante Tanner.
I was like, oh, how you doing? That's Dante Tanner. Cool.
Are you that guy that ran for office?
That's pretty cool.
That was probably one of the coolest feelings.
Yeah.
And there was another breakfast that we went to for the Fairfax County Dems. Uh-huh. I wasn't going to go to it, honestly, because I had lost. The other two Fairfax folks, new ones, they won. I didn't want to keep putting myself because I was still going through my grieving process. Uh-huh. Mm-hmm. They called me up and says, please come. We would love to have you there. Hundreds of people in the room. They called me out specifically. It's like Dante and Dante Tanner for winning after they announced the other two won. And I got a standing ovation in the room and my wife saw it. Uh-huh. It's like, oh, we didn't lose. Uh-huh. Even in our loss, we won.
Would you talk to us about your tattoos?
Sure. So for me, every one I have, I designed over years, just trying to make sure that I was able to tell the story that I want to tell. Uh-huh. The other side of that one too is that I don't want the process to be, drawn out. It's as much of a transformation process for myself as just getting some good ink. Mm-hmm. I can't drag this out. So most people, when they get sleeves, they'll do it over a month's period, right? Mm-hmm. They'll do like a sitting for like 4 or 5 hours, wait 4 or 5 months, let it heal, then go to the next part, etc. I didn't want to do that. Mm-hmm. So in finding my artist, I also wanted to make sure I found somebody who was willing to do a full sleeve in a 3-day period nonstop and get it done, or 4 days if it took 4 days. Mm-hmm. So I found this guy. Give a shout out to Solid Gallery 1 out in LA. Jared is the best. He asked me the question, goes, are you sure? I was like, yes, I'm sure. Yeah, are you willing to do it? Can you handle it? He goes, we got this, let's go. So we planned it out. I got to the shop and says, here's what we're gonna do. Like, here's the plan for it, etc. But all the pieces we had already discussed. And he had did the compass first. The compass was the first part that I had done. And at the time that I got the compass, I was struggling to find myself because I kept getting lost in noise. Mm. And I thought it would be a good representation of always remember your true north, why you're moving, your major purpose. Mm-hmm. If you don't know that, you're always going to be lost. Mm-hmm. Even the design itself, you start getting into it, like it was Aztec, it was North America, it was European, like all different elements and designs go into the compass itself, overlaid in each other, because that's who my family represents. Mm-hmm. We go back generations of English, Middle Eastern, Palestinian, and Israeli in our family. Of course, black here in America, Native American. We can actually trace it back to Blackfoots, like unlike most black folks, right? Mm-hmm. When you start looking at who you are, it's not just one thing. So I wanted to represent that in the compass. That was the first thing I got. Everything else, it was just kind of the story as I was going through my own healing process of abuse. Mm-hmm. I talked to some friends about this before, where from the age of between 5 and 11, I was repeatedly abused by a deacon at the church, my dad's friend. Mm-hmm. My parents didn't know about it. They suspected. I couldn't talk about it. But because I didn't talk about it then, because I wasn't able to process or deal with it, it caused a lot of other anxieties, issues, etc. Mm-hmm. Fake it till you make it, right? I was winging it, but nobody knew what I was going through. And I needed some way to actually have a closure process to, one, let me finally get past it and accept what had happened and use that as a story for others to maybe help them out. But two, it was a way to tell my story my way. Like what I went through, what I want to accomplish, who helped me in that whole process. So as we go along the process, I'll start at the inside, right? I don't know if you can see the inside of it.
Gotta come around.
Come on around. There's an elephant on the inside of my arm with a trunk wrapping the wolf. As many people have called me in the past, I am the wolf. But the elephant's my grandmother. So during my time that I was going through this whole process, my grandmother was the one who was my stabilizing force. Mm-hmm. And she didn't know what happened either. But I had so many anger issues as I was going through this. I had, you know, things I was battling with as a kid, where she was the one who always tempered the outburst, the rage that I couldn't quite deal with because of what I had gone through. So I wanted to make sure that I had that as a representation of it. And again, the artist was really good at depicting that, and I kind of told the story. We looked at that was the inside of it. Then I focused to the two warring wolves here, and there's like, you know, old stories, right? There's two wolves in you and every person, a positive, negative, mm-hmm. a light and a dark. Mm-hmm. Which one wins? And it's always the one you feed the most.
Yeah.
And when you start going through that whole process of knowing, like, all right, this is what I'm battling with. This is what I have to accept. Who am I going to be today? What's going to be my input as I talk about this or as I try to process it? And it's a constant reminder that sometimes you just kind of have to feed the dark, just to process through it. Let it out. Don't try to bottle in and contain it so much. But the other side of it is be the positive growth version of yourself so that it doesn't consume you. It doesn't be the only thing that defines you. It's a part of your story. It absolutely is. But it's not who you are completely. It's what you are after that, that people are going to see and people are going to know.
Why is the elephant wrapping around the wolves?
Oh, that's just a visualization of her protecting me, calming me down. Because her favorite animal her spirit animal is the elephant.
Mm-hmm.
And it's funny, my daughter's is also that. I thought she was going to be a little wolf. No, everything that has come into it is like, man, you are my grandmother embodied mm-hmm. right now.
That's good.
I don't want to have the conversation about reincarnation right now, but I actually thought for a second I saw my grandmother and my daughter. I'm like, how did this happen? Like, in the world? Mm-hmm. So it was comforting. So, and plus, everybody who gave us gifts only gave us elephants, and they mm-hmm. didn't know the story of the elephant.
Oh, wow.
So I was like, oh.
That's awesome.
Thanks, Nana. Appreciate that.
Yeah, the universe.
Right.
Yeah. It's a conspiracy of angels.
I love it, right? The forest. The forest, the lighthouse is in the forest, right? The forest is dead, actually. It's not like a blooming forest, it's a forest in the middle of winter. There's a person standing in the middle of that. We'll leave the story who that person is. But, you know, there's that lighthouse where I want to be a beacon of hope, of an example of what people can follow, what's possible. Mm-hmm. But I know that if you're going to be a lighthouse, sometimes you're not in the best of situations. Like, hey, everything's been great for me. Come follow my path.
Yeah.
Like, no, things have sucked sometimes too.
Mm. You're in a dead forest.
Right. Yeah. But that doesn't mean you can't still progress. You can't still push forward. And it ties perfectly into that lighthouse and the compass, because the compass was the start of the story. Mm-hmm. I don't want to get lost again. Mm-hmm. But of course, I still have my own personal trust issue sometimes. So the wolf for the back is the one that actually always has my back. It's the only wolf I have that is actually of a menacing nature to somebody else. Where the teeth are bared, like, you can't walk over me anymore. Mm-hmm. That's not who I'm going to be. And that's how I wanted to close this tattoo out. Is that, you know, all the things I went through,
yeah,
you're not going to get me again.
It's beautiful.
So that's this one. So I have five wolves total. Mm-hmm. There's one in the middle of my back. I'm not going to show you that one.
I mean, but if you feel like it, I'm... Yeah.
we'll talk about that later, all right? No. So there's a... I know, right? It's easy, right?
I'm sure the ladies in the room would know.
I'll put research, right?
No,
I'll put research.
Need to see it. We need to see it.
We need it for footage.
You.
We need B-roll. B-roll.
I'm pretty sure I have a picture somewhere. I do have a picture of it somewhere, but...
It's the wolf in the back.
But it's the wolf and the dream catcher. And it was actually... Uh-huh. So because of what I went through, I started having night terrors. Uh-huh. Where I couldn't sleep, wake up screaming, was afraid all the time. And for some reason, my grandmother decided to tell a story about, like, you know, the dream catcher. Mm-hmm. And she put a little wolf on my bedstand. And for some reason, that helps with my dreams. And I couldn't define it. I can't explain it. I don't even know why. But that little action right there helped me actually sleep through a period where I couldn't sleep, where I was afraid all of the time, because I wasn't sure who was going to come back and hurt me again. Mm-hmm. And then finally this one right here, it's Veritas as an ambigram. So no matter which way you read it, it's always going to say the truth. Mm-hmm. Because you go through a world where people try to tell you a version of the truth or outright lie to you. But for me, I want to make sure that no matter how you look at me or how our relationship is, I'm always going to be truthful. Mm-hmm. And that was the final one where it's like, all right, this is the truth. That's most important to me when we're talking about how I want to be known. At least I can be honest. My wife almost ruined her own engagement because of how honest I am. Because I can't keep a secret, can't tell a lie. It's a horrible character trait for a politician. But it goes back to ask me a direct question, I give you a direct answer. And it's gotten me in trouble sometimes, and it's helped out a lot too. Yeah. So those are the story of the tattoos. I have a few more coming to include another sleeve that'll go here. Mm-hmm. Something that I've saved here for my daughter. And we'll talk about those next time.
Thank you.
Yeah, I want to just say thank you, man.
Oh, yeah.
This was a transformative and this was a great experience. Yep. I'm going to speak for everyone and then let them speak, but this was a great experience for all of us.
Yeah.
I appreciate you.
Thank you. I appreciate you.
3 a.m. on the West Side Highway, yo, top down,
the
baby.
Motivation for
it's
me,
the blueprint,
fuck
baby.
Y'all. It's been telling me what I could not be. Oh well.
Hey, this is a special dedication. Hey. Thank y'all. I want to thank you for the fuel. No, really, thank you.
Hey, y'all gotta hear this shit.
I felt so inspired by what my teacher said. Said I'd either be dead or be a reefer head. I'm not sure if that's how adults should speak to kids. Especially when the only thing I did was speak in class. I teach his ass, even better's what my uncle did. I pop my demo tape and start to beat my head. Peeked out my eye, see if he was beating heads. He might as well said be the kid, he's on the list. Just like I'm searching for kicks, like a sneaky head. They gon' keep pushing me until I reach the ledge. And when I reach the ledge, I tell them all to eat a deck. Take a leap of faith and let my eagle wings spread.
Motivation for me has been telling me what I could not be. Ooh. Oh well.
Hey,
I'm so ambitious.
Hey,
I might hit two sisters.
Hey,
I'm on a mission.
Hey,
no matter what the conditions.
You get it.
Personal issues.
Then be,
then you can conceive it.
You see,
the motivation for me has been telling me what I could not be, not be, not be, not be, not be. Not be.